Aha, well done. Now, you got your 8T pole. Is your HT listening to the 8.5 output or the 147.375 output? Which output are you listening to on your HT pole, guys?
I'm listening to Selvin, but yeah, it keeps cutting out lately, so I'm not sure why. But, you know, as I'm transmitting now, it's shut down. But I can hear it.
You said that Selvin was shut down, and I was hearing Selvin at that time. So you might be overloading your HT. If you had a coax cable going to your HT and it had another antenna somewhere else in the house or on the property with a cable coming to the HT, you could avoid that overload problem. Just have to put some distance. Turns out that the transmitter on your shelf in your ham room, even though it looks like it's well shielded, you put an HT near it, and it's going to be picking up some stray radiation coming from that box. So you need some distance between your HT antenna and the box of your transmitter that you're using right now. So that's what I'm doing. I've just got two coax cables. One's going to the antenna you're listening to right now, to the repeater, and the other cable is going to an antenna where I'm listening to what's coming back from the repeater. I listen on 8.5, but I have the ability to flip the switch and listen to 3.75. And my audio sounds a little bit more harsh on 3.75 than it does on 8.5. And so I know Eric knows about that. So running full duplex is nowhere near as difficult as the average person thinks it is. The majority of people, I explain to them the advantage of running full duplex. They don't ask any questions. They don't respond. It's just a subject. They don't want to go there. They don't see the advantage of it. If you're running a net, there's a huge advantage to know whether or not your voice is coming through, and if it's not, what words you've got to repeat in order for people listening to get a full statement. Let me drop a quick. I've forgotten the reason for these very precise spheres of Lisa Lyser, I think it is, that are now at Lagrange point number one. And I think you said it's 4 or 5 times more sensitive. There's something about the spin of these spheres, and they're looking for the gravitational drag of them. I'm trying to remember what that experiment was. There's two separate spacecraft, separated by some particular distance, Paul, in this Lyser experiment that's going on right now. Run that by again because I've forgotten it. WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, let's see, there's two different spacecraft we're talking about now. The one with the spheres, I believe that's the Gravity Probe B, and that's looking for gravity being distorted by the spin of the Earth, and then that's the one with the spheres. This one is by, this one's LISA, and I forgot what the acronym stands for, but LISA is the one that European Space Agency put out at the L1 position, and inside the spacecraft, I think, located, it's probably about, I think, 20 inches apart, it's 19 inches apart, are these two cubes, and they're, two heavy cubes, and I forget what they weigh. And they're floating inside the spacecraft. When they went out, they were attached, and then they were released when they got out to L1 and released inside the spacecraft. There's a high vacuum inside the spacecraft, and there's no solar wind or light or anything that could upset the movement of these two spheres. Let me drop it. And what's happening is the idea is to keep them where nothing will interfere with the motion of these spheres. once they could prove that, which they did because they had lasers inside, taking precise numbers down to, I think, the size of the width of the proton of an atom of some small ridiculous number, and they have not moved. They're floating in there in relation to one another, and they had a certain number in mind that would have been good for looking at gravity waves, and it came out to the results were like 5 times better than what they were hoping for. So that's the LISA mission, to see if these cubes would float, not spheres, you know, perfectly in relation to one another inside the one spacecraft. Since that works out, in the future they plan on launching 3 of these spacecraft at the same time. Each one will have a cube floating inside of it, and then if one moves in relation to the other, that means since nothing else could interfere with it, solar, wind, light, nothing, it had to be it will have to be a gravitational wave. KQRIWWSQF.
Yeah, you've got a completely closed spacecraft. You've got a floating object inside that's in a perfect vacuum, and you're sensing the fact that that object is in a very predictable position for a long period of time. But I see a catch, and that is the outside of the spacecraft is continuously being hit with solar wind. And the solar wind is not a steady stream of particles. It comes in puffs. Every time you get a coronal mass expulsion, ejection, coronal mass ejection, I'm not sure which it is, ejection or expulsion, but a CME, every time you get a CME, a puff of solar wind particles running off the surface of the sun at 1 or 2 million miles an hour comes flying across space and hits your spacecraft at Lagrange 1. So the outer surface of the spacecraft is periodically experiencing a puff of pressure. Therefore, your completely floating sphere that reference with the fixed stars of the universe, so to speak, it's staying steady, but the spacecraft around it is periodically being hit with solar wind. So therefore, with reference to the spacecraft sensors looking at your floating object, it's going to look like that floating object moves compared to the spacecraft, because it's a spacecraft being accelerated by a puff of solar wind. I'm wondering why that's not happening, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
No, I don't know how they have the lasers arranged. Or, you know, maybe they have it figured that if the spacecraft moves 1 inch, the laser that's mounted inside the spacecraft will compensate for that. I'm not sure, you know, how they have that attached. I'm assuming that they're taking that into consideration. But, you know, they don't care, you know, in other words, let's say these two cubes are floating 2 feet apart, and you have a 5-foot spacecraft, you know, surrounding it, and if the spacecraft moves, you know, 1 foot one way or the other, they won't care. I'm sure they're compensating for that in their measurements. But what they do worry about is the spacecraft continuing to move and then eventually actually hitting the cube. So to compensate for the actual movement of the spacecraft, they want to push that back to where it belongs. NASA came out with these minute thrusters. I forget, you know, what micro Newton of a thruster. I mean, some really bizarre small numbers that NASA attached to the European Space Agency spacecraft LISA, and they're using that to keep the spacecraft, you know, in a proper position so it doesn't move too much. I think they call them micro thrusters. Back to you, Dick.
The objects that are floating free, you've called them a cube, Paul, or cubes. I thought they were going to be an absolutely perfect sphere, and I thought the sphere was going to be rotating. Maybe I'm confusing that with another spacecraft. I thought there was a spacecraft which has one or two very precise round spheres that I think are rotating, and they're looking for some kind of an effect when these freely rotating objects in a perfect vacuum. So, what individual spacecraft am I confusing? You're sure that the floating objects are spheres, not a cube, not a sphere ball? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, they're cubes, a couple of kilogram cubes each. The one with the spheres, that would be in the gravity probe B, and that's the one that is experimenting with Einstein's, you know, it's part of his theory of relativity, that if a mass like the Earth is turning or rotating, it will drag space-time with it. So that's the one that I believe that's in a real super polar orbit, and that's got these spinning spheres. They're perfectly round spheres. The most perfectly round sphere that they've ever developed is in that spacecraft, floating and spinning. I think they have a couple of them in there for some reason. So that's the one that, as the Earth spins, it's dragging space-time with it. And I believe they've proven it, and then there's a couple of scientists that are saying, wait a minute, let's look a little further into this. It's one of those deals. Back to you, Dick.
This gravity detector, why are those free-floating objects cubes? Is that so that you can easily see any change in XYZ orientation of those cubes? Are we worrying about the translation of the cubes, or the rotation of the cubes, or the combination? And I think you're saying that in the spacecraft, there are a pair of cubes, something like 19 inches apart, and is each cube a couple of cubic centimeters? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'll have to go back and look the exact size, but I believe it was 19 inches apart. Pretty sure of that. And they're cubes. And I suspect the orientation is not going to change as well once they have it all set up. And this was launched back in, I guess, January. And it took maybe before that, because I think it got into that orbit probably in March or April. It was probably launched at the end of last year on a LISA mission. It was launched on a Vega spacecraft, I remember that, out of French Guiana. That's their light-lift vehicle. They have three of them. They have Vega, and then they have Soyuz that they actually bought and they own from Russia. That's the medium-lift vehicle. And then the Ariane 5 rocket. And this is a relatively small spacecraft. Launched on the Vega platform. So, it took probably 4 months to get out there, and they said it was very successful. And that's out of part of it with these micro thrusters that they built. Back to you, Dick.
Are those micro thrusters super miniature ionic engines? Is that what they are, Paul? K2RIW?
I read about them, and they didn't call them ionic engines, but boy, it sure sounded like that. I didn't get that far into it, but creating some kind of micro thrust with these things. They were heating up hydrogen and doing stuff. I forget what it was, but I'll have to look, and maybe they have more details on it. But NASA developed them, and they're glad they work because NASA wants to use them for other applications. You know, I guess maybe fine-tuning something up there for whatever reason. Back to you, Dick.
Paul, if there's proof of concept experiment with the pair of cubes 19 inches apart, if the sensitivity of that experiment was five times higher than they anticipated, with all of that success, why isn't the next step going to launch a bigger version of that a couple of years from now? Why is that being put off 10 or so years? Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody does change that. I think it's 2032. If I looked it up, I'm pretty sure I'm right. 2032 would be the launch date, which is ridiculously long from now. When this whole LISA program was being developed, you got to remember, they shot this thing up into space months before, not that long, but months before the LIGO proved that we could detect gravitational waves at all. And, you know, this thing was on the way out to L1. The reports came in. And then, you know, on top of that, the European Space Agency, you know, had long-term plans. Maybe back in, you know, 2030 or so, 2032, we'll launch the other one if this is successful. But they didn't know that it was even possible to, you know, it might have never been possible. Now, this thing is going to be much more sensitive. They could go down to the lower frequencies. I think they said 100 hertz. Which is they're going to be able to detect a lot more different things that are happening in the universe than, you know, just a couple of black holes, you know, circling around one another and destroying each other. It should be really the beginning of gravity astronomy.
Yeah, it sure does look like gravity astronomy is coming on strong. And for a number of years, LIGO saw nothing. And they kept making improvements and increasing the sensitivity and getting rid of the effects of a train going by 10 miles away and a truck going by 5 miles away and so on. All these objects were deflecting the Earth and affecting their measurements. So for a number of years, it sure looked like LIGO was going to be a bust. I remember reading a number of the articles about LIGO. And they were always talking about doubling and tripling and quadrupling the sensitivity and making this improvement and that improvement. A higher power laser, more bounces of the laser, better frequency stabilization of the laser and so on, better vacuuming and better support, better methods of supporting the mirror. And all of a sudden, they finally got pay dirt. And both LIGOs in Hanford and also in Louisiana, both saw the same event. And by the way, there have been other events, not quite as dramatic, but LIGO has detected other events. You go to the right website and you start seeing the waveforms they've gotten out of other events. I think they've seen now a total of about 3 events. I wonder if you've been keeping track of that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I know there was a second event that was confirmed, but I didn't hear about the third. But yeah, they're well on their way. And then there's Japan has some similar type of thing they're developing that's supposed to be very sensitive that I don't think came online yet. So I think there's another one too being built. I forget where that is. Maybe Germany or someplace. But that sounds like the beginning. You know, one, two, next thing you know, they might have dozens of these gravitational waves passing by. I just wanted to bring up one thing that I was going to mention because some people down in Florida noticed that there's, you know, they're now launching the Falcon 9 down in Florida on a regular basis, and also from California. And the people noticed that there's 3 sonic booms coming back. And then people were wondering why. And there was a report on how that was happening. With the shuttle, you heard 2 sonic booms. And now they're hearing 3. So SpaceX gave their explanation. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, I'll bite. What is the explanation for 3 sonic booms? On top of that, good old Mr. Musk, he's now taken his boosters and brought them back down for a landing. And I think either has or is about to, for the first time, take a booster and use it for the second time, a booster that landed itself. So give us some words on all of the above, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, okay. The explanation that they gave is on a normal aircraft, say a fighter jet that breaks the sound barrier, you'll get two sonic booms coming off the leading one, you know, the wings in the front and the tail. But because it's a relatively short plane, the sonic booms are, when they come back down, they're heard as one. You know, if you're just standing there in Florida and a jet goes by and breaks the sound barrier, you're going to hear one boom. But there's really two involved in that. With the space shuttle, it was a longer spacecraft. So when that came down to land in Florida, and countless landings that they did down there, drop it. They had the two sonic booms off the front wings and off the tail. But the spacecraft itself was longer, so you could hear very quickly, but you could hear two boom, boom, real quick. With SpaceX now, they're landing, what's happening is they're now landing the booster from the Falcon 9. After they launch it, the booster is now, in some cases, coming back to California and landing on landing zone one. And they took over a launch complex 13, and they took over that one, and they now call landing zone one. When I say they, I mean SpaceX. So this has happened now two times, because last December they landed it on landing zone one, and then a couple of weeks ago they did the same thing. The other boosters have been landed out on the drone ships out at sea. But
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
They'll do it. So what's happening, it's coming in tail first, with the rocket engines first. And what's happening is the rocket engines are giving off the first boom, and then they have these big landing legs. That's kind of, you know, that even so, it's they open up at the last second. The landing legs, it's a structure that's, you know, physically sticking out a little bit from the booster. That's giving off the second boom, and then they have these guide wing type of things that pop out on the top of the booster to guide it back to the landing location, and then, you know, they're able to actuate them and move them and guide the booster back down. Those things are sticking out, and that would be the third boom. So they're hearing three booms, and then soon in November, or at the end of November, when they launch the Falcon 9 Heavy, let me drop it, their goal is to bring back all three boosters and land them in Cape Canaveral. So there's a possibility that people there might hear a total of nine sonic booms when these things come back down. Back to you, Dick.
Comment and to you.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, fine, Dick and everybody else. You know, I remember as a child when I lived in Astoria, Queens. It had to be before I was 10 years old, because when I was 10, I moved to Whitestone from Astoria. I remember playing in the street outside the apartments on two occasions. It must have been just during the Cold War. There must have been jets, you know, with military jets. Because on each one, I don't know what time frame each one happened, but I heard ba-boom, you know, two booms, ba-boom. And there were two planes on two separate days. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, when I was at Edwards Air Force Base, quite a number of aircraft flying in the vicinity. We're breaking the sound barrier. And when you hear that sound, it is a ba-doom, is my way of describing it. And an aircraft flying at the speed of sound is moving in the vicinity of 1,000 feet per second. And the nose to tail of the aircraft is what? 40 feet, 30 feet? So 1,000 feet per second and only 30 feet between the front of the aircraft and the back of the aircraft. If it was the front and the back giving you the buh and the doom, there would only be a 30 millisecond difference between the two. It wouldn't sound like ba-doom. The ba-doom is a, you know, a third of a second or a half a second. The explanation I've heard, which may or may not be accurate, let me drop, is that the leading edge of the aircraft, first striking the air, gives you a high pressure wave front. Whatever created the high pressure wave front, the back of the wing, the back of the aircraft, is now creating a low pressure wave front. And those two are separated by some number of milliseconds, a very short period of time. However, that high pressure wave front travels through the air faster than a low pressure wave front. High pressure air travels faster than low pressure air. So by the time it gets to you a mile away, you hear that ba-doom. So it's the difference in velocity of the pressure wave and the rarefaction wave and the mileage between the two. And if you're further and further miles away, I am guessing the difference between the buh and the doom is a longer period of time if you're more miles away. That's a guess on my part. I wonder if you heard anything like that, Paul, or heard any explanations like that. WS2N, K2LIW.
Dick, I want to know, first of all, why don't we hear those today? We heard them in the 50s.
There are very few aircraft that are allowed to fly above the speed of sound in a residential area these days. They're restricted. In the early days, some of those aircraft used to break windows. So in residential areas, you're not allowed to do that anymore. And a place like Edwards Air Force Base, which is this great big dry lake bed with lots and miles of empty fields in many directions, there are no such restrictions. That's what I think is going on there. So what have you heard about all of the above, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, well, I've read that the sound wave is the compression of the air, and it, of course, becomes quite dense, but I never read anything about the timing between the two, so it sounds like a good explanation to me, what you just said, and as far as what Rich is saying about the, you don't hear anything like that anymore, I think... Originally, they planned on building an SST. They call it the SST, and that was the American version of what eventually the English and French joined together and built the Concorde, and then the supersonic transport we were going to have. I remember seeing that in the World's Fair in 1964. I thought this was going to be great, but we dropped it. I guess it was probably Boeing or... not sure who was going to build that, Panasonic, maybe Pan Am. But that was all dropped. But Concorde went ahead and they built it. They went, 1,300 miles an hour over the ocean. But when they got to New York, they had to cut their speed down. I used to see them coming over all the time, roughly around 10 o'clock in the morning if you looked up. And, of course, that's all gone. Now, NASA, let me drop it. NASA has been developing a couple of planes, and they're pretty much onto something. I've read a couple of months ago. It's National Aeronautics and Space Administration. The big part of that is aeronautics, and they're working on having planes be able to get through the sound barrier without, with a very, very little sound barrier influence. And if they could do that, that will change transportation across the world. Back to you, Dick.
What I heard, Paul, was not when they were building the SST or anything like that. I heard it in about, I guess it had to be somewhere around 1957 or 58 or 59. Dick, were they running military jets? I guess they did everything else. And why did I hear it by Astoria, by the Triborough Bridge?
Republic aircraft and Grumman aircraft, but Republic in particular, was making a number of supersonic aircraft in the 50s and 60s, and maybe even the 70s, but they're no longer doing that. But these supersonic aircraft were being tested in the Atlantic Ocean and maybe even the Long Island Sound. So in our near vicinity, we were hearing them. There's nobody building supersonic aircraft in the New York State, Long Island area anymore. The supersonic transport, no, the Concorde, I think had some very strict rules where they had to fly a number of miles out to sea before they were allowed to break the sound barrier. And the same thing coming back. Before they got to close to Long Island, they had to come back down below the sound barrier so as not to be breaking windows and disturbing people. So you'll still hear sound. You'll still hear aircraft breaking the sound barrier out at Edwards Air Force Base, and probably that's in California, Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, probably Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. Around those Air Force bases, I'm pretty sure those people are being subjected to sound barrier sounds. And there's probably some rules as to how low they're allowed to fly when they're doing that so as not to break windows. But, the Concorde, to my knowledge, never broke even, never paid for itself. It was national pride of the European Space Agency, I can't think of the name of it. France and England were subsidizing the Concorde. And when they finally had that crash of the Concorde, they decided to give up the subsidy. I mean, the philosophy was, yeah, we'll pay for it. Let me drop it. We'll subsidize it for 5 years or so. And by then, the clientele who want to go to Europe at the speed of sound and above, twice the speed of sound, and come back, they expected it to eventually have a big enough number of customers that it would pay for itself. That never took place. It burns a lot of fuel. It has a very compact fuselage. It doesn't take a whole lot of passengers. And I suspect that a high percentage of those Concorde flights were only one-third or one-half filled. So I think they eventually came to the conclusion, it'll never pay for itself. Let's not subsidize it any longer. Let's give up on this one. And I think the supersonic transport, somebody did enough back-of-the-envelope calculations to conclude that the United States would have the exact same problem. So, is that the way you saw it, Paul? And also, am I correct in guessing that there was some number of miles, either high in altitude or far away from land, in which they had to go there before breaking the sound barrier with the Concorde? WS2N, K2RIW.
After Paul answers, Dick, I would like to know, what I heard in the 1950s, were those experimental flights or military during the Cold War? Paul, over to you, sir.
Cut down your radio, Rich.
I know too much audio. I have to take care of that. I sent a ICOM an email.
Okay, very good. Well, let's see. That was about the year that when John Glenn made the fastest flight from across the country. He set the record. I think it was like 3.5 hours or something. Well, you know, this is before he became an astronaut. So, you know, they used to do stuff like that. Like Dick said, they might have been running experimental flights military. So, 59. Well, let's see, what it was October, I believe October 14th, 1947, when Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier. So, they've been at it ever since, 47. That way, you're thinking 59, probably 12 years later. By then, they had quite a few planes that could do that. So, I don't know. Dick, you asked me a question, but it went out of my head. I got Bob with Rich's comment. Back to you, Dick.
Comment, Dick? Go ahead, John.
AC2WGB. Dick, I'm sure you've been out to Miramar. Last time I was out there was 2001, and they're still breaking the sound barrier. You hear them regularly. Whether they've stopped it or not, I don't know, but in 2001, it was going on daily.
Yeah, I'm convinced that many of the aircraft, Navy or Air Force bases, have fighter aircraft that are breaking the sound barrier periodically during their practices. We just happen not to have any of those air bases in the New York City area. But I guarantee the people at Wright-Patterson in Ohio, Eglin in California, Miramar in California, Eglin in Florida, Edwards in California, Miramar in California. Miramar is Navy. Edwards is Air Force. I think in Miramar, I think it's the place they call Top Gun. Yeah, I think that's the Navy fighter pilot training area. But the question I was asking you, Paul, maybe you know, was it true that the Concorde had to be at some particular altitude and some number of miles away from New York City before they were allowed to break the sound barrier so as to protect our windows and not anger people? WS2N, K2RAW.
Oh, yeah, that was definitely true, because I saw it many times, and not once did I ever hear it hit a barrier broke by the Concorde. So, yeah, they would slow down over the ocean. They would circle around. I always saw them above the, in Westbury, if you were in Westbury, around 10 o'clock, 10:15, on a regular basis. And then, you know, they were coming into Kennedy. So that was interesting plane to see. And I think they first started flying in 1976. They did pretty good. Toward the end, though, they did lose their Concorde. They lost everybody on board, leaving Europe. So they did lose one of them. They had the big Rolls-Royce engines. And I don't think they had many passengers, probably a little over 100, maybe 108 or something, some small number. That was the max. So, they probably went broke trying to keep that plane going. But, you know, that was their pride and joy. Back to you, Dick.
And that was being continuously subsidized by England and France. What was the name of the aircraft agency that was running that Concorde, Paul? Do you remember the name?
No, I know it was a collaboration between France and England. But, no. When I hear it, of course, I'll know it. Yeah, it'll come to me. It's not Kness. Kness is the word that they use for the French space agency. But I think it was a subdivision of that. Back to you.
I heard somebody give us a fraction of a word. Go right ahead, sir.
Good afternoon, Dick. WO2Z. I think it was Dassault was the name of the company.
That may have been a company that did a lot of the construction, but that's not the name of the company I'm trying to think of. who also has been making a number of European commercially made aircraft that are competing with Boeing. Why can't we think of the name of that?
You mean Airbus, do you, Dick?
Yes, I do. Airbus is the name of the thing I was trying to think of. Was Airbus, to your knowledge, John, was Airbus involved with the Concorde in any way?
As far as I know, it was a consortium between BOAC and Air France. I think those were the two mainstays. Whether Airbus was involved, I'm not sure. I don't think so.
Probably not then. Let me make sure that we got the, yep, East input is working. The sound barriers, we used to hear it a lot around New York area. On top of that, in the late 40s, early 50s, I was living in Farmingdale, on Yoakum Avenue in Farmingdale. And 2 o'clock in the morning, half the nights of the week, you would hear jet engines being tested at Republic Aircraft. Very wild, loud sound of these engines, of these aircraft, running continuously. I wonder if anybody heard a little bit of a buzz in my transmission a few seconds ago.
No buzz, Dick. This is N2EO. Why was the Concorde, the nose would tilt down until they got up to a certain height? Why was that? And when they came down, they tilted the nose down.
Yeah, I'm getting a failure of my power company. My UPS is going on and off periodically. The Concorde, when it's flying at a medium speed, it's about to land, it has to have an extremely high angle of attack. That nose is tilted up, let me pick a number, what looks like 15 degrees in the air. As such, the pilot would not be able to see over that nose to see the runway. So to correct for that, the nose of the aircraft tilts down so that the pilot can see the runway. But it needs a very high angle of attack. It's got a relatively small wing very far back. And so it's designed for supersonic flight. It's relatively inefficient at non-supersonic flight, so it needs this very high angle of attack. And that final crash of the Concorde, what did it in, let me drop that, was that there was a piece of foreign object, a piece of molding came off of an aircraft on that runway. And the Concorde has to go, I don't know what number, but something like 250 miles an hour to take off. And when the wheels of that aircraft struck that piece of molding, the metallic structure that was on the runway, it tore up that wheel. That wheel has got some very strong metallic fibers in it. So this wheel spinning at 250 miles an hour, torn apart by this chunk of shrapnel, threw pieces, through very high speed pieces of metal into the wing of the Concorde. It pierced the tank. So now you have fuel leaking out of the wing at a very high rate, being sucked into the input turbines of an engine. And the engine was really running extremely rich, giving them very low thrust. So the engine is being hit with fuel, making these great big flames, giving them low thrust, and the airplane was basically not flying. But the aircraft basically stalled and crashed into an apartment building. I think everyone on board died during that accident. Is that what you heard also, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, I heard they lost everybody on that. Yeah, they couldn't. You can't blame the plane, but you can't hit something a couple of hundred miles an hour and survive that. So, not much more to add here. But the Concorde was good to watch. I remember seeing it at the airport with the the nose down, like Rich said. And that was, that's the same explanation I heard, just for the pilot, you know, so that they could see what they were doing. Meanwhile, it's a lot of money poured into the into that jet to be able to make that kind of maneuver to be able to lower the front end like that and raise it back up just for viewing purposes. I wonder if it was done today, if they would just would have left it alone and had a bunch of cameras looking out, or just did everything with, you know, robotically. Back to you, Dick.
I don't think so, Paul. In the case of Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, in the beginning, there were multiple offers to build those spacecraft with completely solid walls and let the pilot look at a camera and look at a screen. And those astronauts said, no way, Jose. If a pilot cannot see the runway, he's not going to fly that airplane or that spacecraft. Every pilot knows, no matter what the hell electronics you're using, the day will come when the electronics will fail. And now you're completely blind. They absolutely, positively insisted, you will put a window in Mercury. You will put a window in Gemini. The pilot's got to be able to see out the window. They knew full well the window represented a serious problem of temperature protection and pressurization and possible failures and whatever. As far as the spacecraft design is concerned, the window is was a serious problem. Those pilots said, we will not fly that spacecraft if I cannot look out that window. My eyes must see the visual target that I'm flying toward, away from, or whatever. They have no faith in a camera that can too easily fail. That's sort of the same reason why it is my belief, let me drop this. It's my belief that all aircraft, for a long time to come, are going to have a pressure-sensing altimeter, which is really a barometer, a ball bank indicator, a pressure-sensitive airspeed indicator, a very simple kind of engine RPM indicator. They want extremely reliable, classic methods of instrumentation, the vital instrumentation, altitude, angle of attack, artificial horizon, airspeed, RPM, ball bank indicator. I'll bet you aircraft for decades to come are going to have those high reliability instruments on that instrument panel. That's my belief. Because the philosophy of a pilot is you got to have reliability. You got to have situation awareness. And they don't trust any instrumentation. Put as fancy electronics in there that you want to as a backup to give finer details of something. But it's not going to be the primary instrumentation that allows you to fly that airplane. That's what I believe is the philosophy of a pilot. Now, this is the space section of the TechNet. Does anybody have any further questions for Paul or anybody else about spacecraft, airplanes, whatever, for this particular section? Give us your call letters right now if you want to ask any questions. K2IIW listening.
A quick note before that, Dick. The first two Mercury spacecraft went up without windows because they were already built. They rammed it down their throat, but they couldn't see out. They had to use a periscope. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, was John Glenn the very first manned Mercury mission? Are you telling me he had to look out a periscope? At least with a periscope, he really could visually see the environment. So you're telling me the very first Mercury, and I think it was John Glenn, are you telling me he didn't have a window, Paul, WS2N, K2LIW?
John Glenn had a window, but he wasn't first. The first two missions were already planned without windows, and so that's why John Glenn wound up with a window. The first two missions was Alan Shepard, was a suborbital flight launched on a Redstone rocket, followed by Gus Grissom, also on a Redstone rocket. They were probably 15-minute flights. They'd get up to 5,000 miles an hour, get into space, and then come right back down into the ocean, into the Atlantic Ocean, just to prove that, you know, proof of concept. So that's what happened there. And then Glenn had a window. Everybody else after that had a window. But those first two missions, they just had periscopes. They had to, and they had to make sure they were closed before they re-entered back to the...
So you're telling me Alan Shepard had only a periscope, and Gus Grissom, I believe his particular capsule sunk. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, Liberty Bell. That went down the drain. Supposedly the hatch blew off. Grissom said he didn't hit the button. It blew off. It was for some reason unintentional. Pyrotechnics went off. The hatch blew. He eventually got out and started swimming around. Got off the water into pursuit. He started going down. The helicopter was trying to pull Liberty Bell out of the water without him in it. Then they saw he was finally having trouble. They pulled him out of the water, and they couldn't hang on to it. They tried pulling Liberty Bell out, but there was too much water in it. It was too heavy, and it sunk to the bottom. Decades later, of course, it was recovered. So it's in some museum right now. Back to you, Dick.
And you had a question there, John. Go ahead.
AC2WGB. Yeah, Dick. Your discussion, knife edge refraction, is it the same in a vacuum as it is in atmospheric conditions, if you know?
Yeah, absolutely. The knife edge diffraction you get of a bright light behind a sharp edge, it's got nothing to do with the air per se, John. That is pure optics phenomenon. Mother Nature doesn't like a sharp discontinuity. So some of the energy flows around that knife edge. So if you had a very dark room and a very sharp point of light, and you're holding a razor blade in front of your eye, and you slowly raise the razor blade so that you try to cut off that light in the dark room, the edge of that razor blade will be lit up as if the steel is transparent where you've got the sharp edge. That's the way it will look like. Talk to anybody who has done a Foucault test. It's a kind of a test that measures the accuracy of a parabolic mirror that you're grinding. You will see that phenomenon, that knife edge diffraction. I'm trying to remember, knife edge diffraction is the simple way of describing it. It's got another fancy man's name and a fancy chunk of mathematics associated with it. But light will crawl around that edge. An electromagnetic wave will crawl around a sharp edge. Oh, it may be attenuated by 30 dB, but it doesn't get thoroughly attenuated. So that by the same token, let me drop this. I just had a nice long telephone conversation with Kent Britton, WA5EJB. He's the guy that is the president of Kent Electronics in Grand Prairie, Texas, right outside of Dallas. He makes these printed circuit VHF, UHF antennas. He's been doing that for 15 or 20 years. For the last 30 years in a row, he has run the antenna gain competition at the Central States VHF Society meetings. This last weekend, ending today, was the 50th anniversary of the Central States VHF Society. Let me drop. And what the experiment that he finally did today during the antenna gain competition, he did it yesterday, Saturday, because Dave Aline, K1WHS, the president of the antenna company, I'm trying to think of the name of his company right now, Directive Systems. For a whole lot of years, he ran a company called Directive Systems that made some very high technology UHF SHF Yagis. His biggest Yagi was a 3.3 gigahertz Yagi with, I think, 56 elements to it. So, anyhow, Dave Olean, K1WHS, has a number of published articles saying that when you're mixing antennas together on a single mast, you must calculate the effective capture area of each antenna, and the antennas must be separated by that diameter so that they don't have overlapping areas. And if all the antennas you're separating on your mast are on the same frequency, he's right. If they're on different frequencies, he's wrong. But his, all of his articles say you have to do that regardless. The Finco 6 and 2 meter antenna on that was manufactured in roughly 1962. In other words, on one boom you had 6 meter elements and 2 meter elements, and it worked like a charm. We've all heard of the tri-band antenna. Works on 20, 15, and 10 meters. So you've got 20 meter antenna elements, 15 meter elements, and 10 meter elements, all mounted on the same boom. If you're smart enough in the design, the individual areas don't overlap if they're on different frequencies. They don't appear. So in order to prove this, I mean, Dave Olean has said that if you're putting a two-foot dish on your mast, you must put it a large number of feet away from your two-meter Yagi, otherwise it's going to disturb the Yagi.
Repeater, timeout.
The experiment that Kent did yesterday was to take a 10-gig dish, 2 feet in diameter, and hold it where the edge of the dish was touching the boom of a 8-element 2-meter Yagi that was on the antenna range he was running. And depending on where he put the 2-foot diameter dish, with the edge of the dish touching the boom above or below the Yagi, he never saw more than a tenth of a dB of gain change. And sometimes the gain was an increase, not a decrease. What he finally did, where he's got the antenna, the 2-meter Yagi is on a great big mast, and on a wooden boom, he's holding up the 2-foot diameter 10-gig dish. He held the 2-foot diameter dish directly in front of the Yagi, and the gain went down 4/10 of a dB. You might say, what the hell's going on here? It turns out that a 8-element Yagi on 2 meters has an effective capture area of about a 10-foot diameter circle. Let me drop. So that antenna, if you could look down the throat of the antenna and if your eyes operated on 2 meters, you would see a black circle roughly 10 feet in diameter. The 2-foot dish, the 10-gig dish that he's holding directly in front of it, is creating a little bit of a blockage of 2 foot in diameter. A 2-foot diameter dish and a 10-foot diameter capture area, what's the ratio between the two? 80% of the area is unblocked area outside of the perimeter of the 2-foot dish. That's why he only saw 4/10 of a dB of gain change. It's good theory. Lots of people predicted the 2-foot dish in front. I mean, you got a 2-foot diameter dish, and each of the elements of the Yagi are, 3 foot long. And so you would think that you're blocking 80% of the area of the dish. Your eye shows you a huge amount of blockage. That's not what the radio wave sees. That radio wave looking down that Yagi is looking at a 10-foot diameter of space. And all that energy gets folded down, gets focused down to that driven element. Let me drop it. So that was a beautiful experiment that proved what's really going on. It's another one of those situations where, in antenna theory, quite often the truth is stranger than fiction. Okay, we're at the bewitching hour. That was TechNet number 1613 that you just heard. And Space Report number 212. 72, you all. Be kind to each other. I'm going to pass it over to John. And I wonder, John, would you have predicted that that 2-foot dish would have such a minor effect on a 2-meter Yagi? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I believe it because I've done so many combinations on a single mast, and if they were not resonant, I could not actually tell that they were causing any influence at all. You need some modicum of spacing, but like I say, if it's not resonant, it's not going to see the signal, so maybe it just means nothing. But good experiment anyway. Tennis.